This is Page Grade Theory 2, Unit 12, Part 2, Abdo Pain. So we talked about abdo assessment last week, and let's talk about abdo pain. You know, it's interesting, mesenteric artery occlusion, I've only seen one of these, the only chief complaint was just severe constant pain in the abdomen. So, and that's not uncommon for many of the abdo pains, is the symptoms are vague and nonspecific. But you remember the three things that should alert you to abdo pain that's potentially life-threatening? Not the type of condition, but yeah.
Like sudden, constant pain?
Sudden, constant, and not sharp necessarily.
Severe.
Yeah. Sudden, constant, severe. Those three things, the hallmarks of something that could be a vascular catastrophe. I love that, vascular catastrophe. I feel like I want to cut myself. Not intentionally, but and say, well, at least it's not a vascular catastrophe. I shouldn't joke about that stuff, because last time I joked about heart attacks, I had one. So the karma might just be catching up to me at my age. You know, it's finally catching up. Meanwhile, I'll trip and whack my head against something. We typically see this in patients with underlying cardiac disease, especially dysrhythmias like AFib, atrial flutter, but particularly AFib, and patients with heart valve disease or regurgitation, because clots form around the heart, especially in AFib, where the atria are just a quivering mass; they're not contracting, and so you can get mural thrombi. Mural meaning wall; that's French for wall. All bad things are French. Because French sounds much nicer than, you know, you got a clot on your wall, as opposed to you've got a mural thrombus. Oh, mural thrombus, that sounds lovely. You wouldn't eat snails, but you might eat escargot. Again, French, right? Sounds much better in French. So if one of the mesenteric vessel occludes, obviously you get ischemic pain. That tends to be out of proportion with patients up here. So mortality rate is extraordinarily high, 70 to 90%. Appendicitis, I wouldn't say it's something we commonly see, but because most people make their own way to either a walk-in clinic or the emergency department, but it is overall the most common abdominal emergency seen in the ER and in walk-in clinics, and it's caused by either bacterial or viral infection or obstruction. And the appendix can become gangrenous and can rupture. If it ruptures, that's not a good thing, because people tend to become septic, which is a widespread infection, right? So early onset presents with visceral pain, so pain that comes and goes. And later it becomes somatic, so it becomes localized, and typically localizes to McBurney's point, which is halfway between the umbilicus and the iliac crest. It's exciting, eh?
Riveting.
Triple A's, so abdominal aortic aneurysm. I should pause this for a second recording. So the question was, can they reinforce it? They'll just replace it, right? So they'll surgically cut those two sections and just replace it with a mesh. I can't remember the name of the material they use, but they do it with a mesh. We when I get someone with a abdominal aortic aneurysm where they're dissecting and there's evidence that it's evolving, or a thoracic aortic dissection, the things I really worry about are sneezing. Because literally a sneeze can cause it to rupture. And I had two AAAs with a sneeze. One, we flew him to Toronto. We landed on the roof of SickKids, and I'll never forget this. We got into the elevator. We're going to go to Toronto General, and when you land the helipad at SickKids, to get to Toronto General, instead of going across Girard Street, which is where all the taxis drive, and you risk everyone's life by doing that, we always went under the tunnels to Toronto General. Anyway, in the elevator going down from SickKids, our patient sneezed, and he had this look of impending doom on his face. He said he felt something pop, and sure enough, he went pale very quickly. His blood pressure dropped very quickly. So we went down, we went across the street, and with the stretcher in this guy, we went into the emerge, and we said, I said to the ER doc, I think it's ruptured. And he said, okay, go to the OR now. So he called a nurse over, take him up to the OR. We went to the OR. We transferred him over to the bed in the operating room. They had him anesthetized and they had him cut open and they cross-clamped his aorta before we even had the straps back on our stretcher and the D-bars back up to get the guy out. I've never seen anything so fast. Anyway, he survived, which is a miracle. On the flip side, we had a guy not far from here, actually north of here. We went to pick him up in the ER, and same thing. AAA sneezed, ruptured his aneurysm. The ER doc, who also had some surgical experience, felt the only way to save this guy is to take him straight to the OR. There was no time to call for a surgeon. He asked us if we'd go in and help, which is crazy. So we went in. The only thing we did for help was we helped hang some blood, and anyway, opened him up, and his aorta was shred right up past his kidneys. So it was shred from the iliac artery up the aorta and past the kidneys, just complete shredded. So there was no way to repair it, no possible way, even if you cross-clamped the aorta above the kidneys. It was just, so he exsanguinated. But Riley's not here to appreciate that term, so. It's amazing how quiet that table is. Yeah.
She's going to hear that on the recording.
Would it be bad to say that I like it? Yes.
I was watching that Hour to Save Your Life series on Netflix, and in the state, or not the state,
oh,
they have something called Ribola.
Oh, yeah, Ribola, yeah. Yeah.
Would that be something that may be introduced into the North American practice at some point? Or?
Yeah, I think it's actually being done in the U.S. Ribola is where they insert a balloon up the femoral artery, I think it is, right? They insert a balloon, so they access the femoral artery from the groin. They insert a catheter up the artery and just basically fill up the balloon and occlude the artery to stop the bleed. I'm not sure how that's done exactly or how far they advance it or how that works, but anyway, amazing stuff. And there's talk about paramedics actually doing it in the field, at least critical care paramedics. So, yeah, that's cool. What's that show called again? Yeah, you guys should watch that stuff. The reality TV shows and stuff is very cool. Very cool stuff. Okay, so usually found between the bottom of the renal arteries and the top of the iliac arteries, and can dissect into the iliac arteries, and that's why it's necessary to do what assessment in someone with tearing-like periembolical pain. What do you need to assess besides their abdomen? Yeah, for distal pulses, color, Capri, sorts of things. If you see a pulsatile mass, don't palpate it. Now, you should be able to see a pulsatile, like pulsations on anyone's abdomen, like the aorta will pulsate. If you're lying next to someone who's naked and you look at their belly, you'll see it pulsate. Again, just a word of warning, like, when you're sleeping with someone you care about, be really careful not to stare too much at their hand veins or their pulsating aorta or their neck veins or, you know, things that will totally creep them out because of your nerdy paramedic ways. So, now, if you're in a close relationship with another paramedic, you know, no limits, right? Oh, I love the way your external jugular veins bulge when you're angry. So typically, I'm not making anyone feel awkward, am I?
No.
No, okay, good.
We took your joke and ran with it a little further.
Oh, yeah. The rest of us probably don't want to hear about it.
No. Yeah.
Of course.
Okay. I'm trying to make this discussion memorable. So typically described as a tearing or ripping pain through the back. And so look for a pulsatile mass. Epigastric pain, so gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, is extraordinarily common. I would say every second patient you'll encounter at the age of 60 will be on Pantaloc or Pantoprazole or Pantoprazole, yeah, for GERD, right? What's that, GERD? Yeah, so a lot of people on GERD. Anyone have, anyone looked at their parents' meds or grandparents' meds? Anyone done that yet? Yeah, okay, good. That's it? Like three of you? The rest of you just don't care about your family? So. Aren't you curious? Don't you want to talk to them? Learn about their meds? No. No. Nice. Nice. My family, they think I'm a nurse. They think I'm a pharmacist. I don't know what they, you know, they come to me for all the questions. Like, what's this medication? Well, that one I don't know. I'm going to have to look it up. So maybe caused by peptic ulcers. When there's a break in the lining of the esophagus or the stomach, it typically presents with a gnawing or burning sensation. It's very unlikely you'll ever get a 911 call for GERD, but GERD can mimic MI. So if someone tells you they have acid reflux or indigestion, they've never had it before, it just feels odd, you can't rule out myocardial infarction. Yeah.
Actually, I had that since I was like 11, and sometimes it's really bad enough for you to actually get arm pain and jaw pain too.
Yeah. Radiating pain, so you've had jaw pain with it?
Yes.
Really? Wow. That's unpleasant. So just remember that it could be cardiac related, right? Any abdominal discomfort could be cardiac. Any chest discomfort could be abdominal. Bowel obstruction, so commonly occurs in the elderly. So the intestinal pathway becomes blocked with fecal material. Hate when things get blocked with fecal material. So we want to find out, if they've got abdominal pain, they may not even think that it's fecal impaction. We want to find out when their last bowel movement was. Was it a normal stool, a loose stool, a watery stool? When did they last have a pee? Those sorts of things. So they haven't had a bowel movement in 2, 3, 4 days, and maybe that's not uncommon for them, but it should be a red flag for you and me. Do they have flatus? Do they have obstipation, which is no gas or bowel movements? Obstipation. I love that, as opposed to constipation, obstipation. I don't think I've ever used that term, but that'd be a good one to put in your documentation just to puzzle the nurses a bit. So typical signs and symptoms, they've got abdominal distension, nausea, vomiting, crampy abdominal pain. There may be localized cramping pain. If the onset is abrupt, it's likely an obstruction. Pancreatitis, this is a nasty, nasty condition. So that's inflammation of the pancreas due to poor production of digestive enzymes. typically presents with a sharp twisting pain in the left upper quadrant or in the epigastric area, so the subxiphoid area. may radiate to the back. There may be fever, nausea, vomiting, abdominal distension. I've seen patients with pancreatitis who were septic and even in septic shock. Diaphoresis, rebound tenderness. How do you assess for rebound tenderness? Jamie? Oh, I thought you had your hand up.
Oh, no, sorry.
Okay, anybody else?
When you let go.
Yeah, so you gotta push down really deep, just around the area of the flank, and then let go quickly. Yeah, see if there's rebound tenderness. But one of the telltale signs is every bump in the road is excruciatingly painful, and they often assume a fetal position. That's very common. You can usually find me in a fetal position under my office desk when I'm marking papers. Moaning. Oh. Matt?
So we were in clinic about 4 weeks ago. There was a patient who came in with pancreatitis, and they were pulling her knees up a bit. She was
Pulling her knees up, yeah. That's classic. Gallstones or cholelithiasis. These are stones that are formed in the gallbladder from cholesterol saturated with bile, and then it calcifies, can obstruct the bile duct, and typically presents with sharp localized pain in the right upper quadrant. And this can radiate to the chest and the neck and the jaw. So it can present similar to cardiac. They tend to be restless, nauseated. There may be vomiting. Pain can also radiate to the back, chest or neck. And oftentimes they've got a history of past occurrences. And if you ask them, they might tell you that it comes on when they eat ice cream or anything really fatty, cheesy pizza, you know, triple cheese on the pizza. Or the pizza I like, the one with the cheese in the crust. That's disgusting. I actually don't like that. I think that's revolting. GI bleeding. So rupturing of these esophageal varices, where we most often see, so you can get GI bleeding anywhere along the GI tract, starting at the esophagus, but where we, when we most often see something like an esophageal varices rupture is in alcoholics. And alcoholics, because they develop liver disease, right? They destroy their Kupffer cells, and they develop a kind of a portal hypertension. So the blood that goes to and from the liver backs up, and it backs up into the esophagus, and the esophageal veins become distended. They become varicose, and swallowing something like a piece of toast can cause a laceration in the esophageal varices, and they can literally exsanguinate from that. It's really unbelievable. I remember I was at the office of the chief coroner's many years ago, and this guy exsanguinated in the hospital the night before with blood in his gut, and they did an autopsy, and they went through all the systems, and they found literally what looked like a pinhole in his esophagus and determined that's where he bled from. So the blood just came out of there at a steady pace all night long and filled his stomach and his GI tract, because his blood just threw out everywhere. And they attributed it to this little pinhole in the esophagus. It was really quite remarkable. Now, if you ever get a patient you transfer with, well, first of all, if you ever get a patient at home with an esophageal bleed, there'll just be a lot of vomit coming out of their mouth, right? So the question in your mind should be, is that vomit, or is that blood rather, coming from the esophagus or the gut, or is it coming from his lungs? Right? So you want to find out if there was a cough or a chest infection or anything like that. If not, it's probably coming from his esophagus or his gut. If you ever called to transport a patient from one hospital to another for an esophageal bleed, typically they'll put a Blakemore tube in. So a Blakemore tube is like an oral gastric tube. Have you seen an oral gastric tube in a patient yet in the hospital? Yeah? Four or five of you have? Okay, so it's like an oral gastric, basically a tube with a balloon on it, like a long balloon, about this this much of the tube is balloon. And they'll have the patient swallow it, and then they'll inflate the balloon to compress the bleed from inside the esophagus. Makes sense, right? It's pressure on the bleeding, and that controls it. The only difficult part, really difficult part, is that tube comes out of the mouth, and somehow you have to keep it there so it doesn't come out or doesn't slide down too far. So typically what they'll do in hospital is they'll tie a string to the end of that tube and attach it to like an IV pole or something to just keep it at that certain length. Somehow you've got to undo that and connect it to your IV pole and make sure that patient doesn't move. So once you get him into one position on the stretcher, she or he cannot move. You can't lay them down, you can't sit them up, because the tube will slide, the compression will be gone, and the bleeding will start, right? So it's the most awkward procedure to maintain that I've ever had to deal with. So that's a Blakemore tube, yeah. So you can get peptic ulcers, a Mallory-Weiss tear of the esophageal gastric junction with severe retching. So whenever I see people vomiting, especially when they're vomiting and it's a dry heave, like nothing's coming up, I always worry they're going to get a tear at their esophageal gastric junction. That's a Mallory Weiss tear. And it's when it happens, they'll know because it's exquisitely painful and it bleeds. And so they might have been, if you get a history of someone who was vomiting, you know, liquids, food, whatever, and then blood started coming up, and they've got a history of retching and retching and retching, you worry about a Mallory Weiss tear. So as a medic, it makes me a lot more cautious about how I vomit. That sound weird, but you think about these things, right? So if I'm vomiting, I'm kind of going, you know, trying not to, you know, trying to control my, just like a sneeze, you know, just let it all out, because if you hold it in, I worry about like developing a Barry aneurysm in my head or something, and blowing an aneurysm. I know Nikita's looking at me like, Terry, oh, you were really screwed up in the head. Do I really want to go into this profession? It does change you, but you think about these things. Yeah. Okay. Just trying to keep this memorable. Rectal abnormalities can cause GI bleeding. So when you're looking at GI bleeding, it's coming out one of two ways. It's coming out your mouth, or it's coming out your posterior canal, right? Your anal orifice. Your derriere, your tush, as you say. So it's not your job or my job to determine where the GI bleed is exactly, but if you've got tarry stools, then it's probably an upper GI bleed that's made its way down and you know, became tarry along the way. If someone's vomiting coffee grounds emesis, it might be mid GI or so. So, different textures, consistencies. So, frank red blood. When they say, when you can see the blood, when you can see the red color, they call it frank. I don't know why it's called frank red blood, but yeah, maybe. It's a hot sauce. Yeah. So. So if someone's vomiting frank red blood, you know the GI bleed is probably high up. If they're vomiting dark blood, it's probably lower down, so like a coffee ground emesis. Molina's stool is more of a dark, really stinky stool. Bright red stool would be a lower GI bleed. There's nothing like the smell of Molina in the morning in a nursing home. It's just, it's an awful smell. Lydia?
So Lucas and I on Monday in our placement got to see a lady who was, they thought she had a GI bleed.
Okay.
And she was vomiting. It was like really, really dark red, almost brown. Yeah. And it was like quite mucusy looking, like shimmery. It was, yeah.
Almost really interesting. Like a
brownish sludge. Yeah. A brownish sludge.
And her blood pressure was just dropping and dropping and dropping.
And was it a GI bleed?
They were pretty sure.
Yeah.
They couldn't get a line.
Oh.
They're waiting for a PIP, and they had an ICU nurse come to try and get a line. They had like seven different nurses try. In the end, the PIP was taking too long, so they ended up putting fluid through one foot and blood through the other foot.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Do you remember what a hemoglobin was when they checked it?
56.
56. Ooh, that's bad. I think for women it's around 140 to 170 hemoglobin. So 56 is like near exsanguination. I do like that word. That and paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea and bilateral periorbital ecchymosis. But yeah, that's nasty. That's a nasty bleed.
Wow.
Exsanguination is in French.
No, it's not in French.
No. Ectopic pregnancy. So we talked about this before. So whenever you're dealing with a woman who's got sudden severe abdominal pain, especially lower abdominal pain, and she's of childbearing years, we always assume it's ectopic pregnancy until proven otherwise. Now, she might say to you, there's no way I'm pregnant, and that's fine. When she gets to hospital, they'll do a pregnancy test anyway, just to rule that out, because occasionally women come in pregnant and have no idea they're pregnant, and are adamant there's no way they're pregnant. Happens sometimes. In fact, some people deliver babies and are adamant that they weren't pregnant and they weren't having sex. So but there's no such thing as immaculate conception. So this is when the fertilized egg implants outside the uterine cavity, so presents with sudden, extreme, unilateral lower abdominal pain, or could be across the lower abdomen, worse by palpation. Pain can be referred to the shoulders, usually around the 6-week gestational mark. So 6, 7, 8 weeks, we really start to worry about ectopic pregnancy. So we want to find out if she's pretty sure she's not pregnant, and it doesn't matter, we're not going to get into a debate about it, but you want to find out, when was her last menstrual cycle, is her menstrual cycle regular, those sorts of things. Has there been any bleeding, or are there any colored vaginal fluids recently? That's what an ectopic pregnancy looks like. That's a horrible photo. Oh. Disturbing photo, yeah. Yeah, I know, it's awful. Sorry. That's a business you're going into, so suck it up, buttercup. Renal colic. We see a lot of renal colics. You're going to see a lot of renal colics. They present with sudden severe pain. Flank pain, typically radiating down to the groin, writhing of pain. I once had a woman who had vaginal pain, an elderly patient who had vaginal pain, only vaginal pain, no pain anywhere else whatsoever, and it turned out she had renal colic, which was a real surprise to me, so you never know. So you've got to keep a list of things in your differential diagnosis when you're thinking about what's maybe going on. Vomiting with the pain is a common occurrence. May have had a previous history. Which is worse, vomiting then pain, or pain then vomiting? Pain then vomiting, yeah, so that's always a bad sign. When the pain is that bad, it causes them to vomit. Do people faint from pain? You know, they talk about it in the movies, but I've never in my life seen or heard of anyone fainting from the pain. They might faint from hyperventilation, but they don't typically faint from the pain. Unfortunately, they just suffer. So if you're ever in excruciating pain and you're hoping to faint, just remember that fainting only lasts a couple of seconds, right? That's by definition, that's what a faint is. So you're just going to, it's not like it's going to go away when you faint. It'll just come back a few seconds later. May have a previous history of the same, maybe blood in the urine. So questions you need to ask about abdominal pain. We need to ask about the OPQRST and associated signs and symptoms and pertinent negatives, right? So pertinent negatives for abdominal pain would be, well, give me an example. What would be some pertinent negatives in abdominal pain?
Discoloration.
Of the abdomen?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Anything else? Yeah.
No pain or palpation.
No pain or palpation, yeah, that would be good. What else? There's some questions about bodily function you need to ask every single patient with abdo pain.
No nausea, vomiting.
No nausea, vomiting, right? That would be a pertinent negative. What else? Peeing is fine. No blood in the urine. Stooling is fine. No blood in the stool. So we want to ask about fluids coming out of the orifices, right? Mm-hmm. Anything coming out of the mouth? Anything coming out of the penis, it shouldn't be coming out of the penis. Anything coming out of the vagina, it shouldn't be coming out of the vagina. Anything coming out your ass, it shouldn't be coming out your ass. So we want to ask things about any difficulty peeing? No. Any blood in your pee? No. Any increased frequency in your pee? No. Any urgency to pee that didn't exist before? No. When you have a poop, when's the last time you had a poop? Is a poop normal stool? Soft stool, watery stool, all water, any blood, right? So think about the orifices and ask about what's coming out of the orifices with any abdominal pain. It's guaranteed when you get to the triage nurse is going to ask you, what about peeing? If you didn't ask, don't pretend like you know. Just go to the patient and just say, hang on, I didn't ask that question. Let me ask the patient. Just admit it. Chelsea?
Are questions about like hesitancy, dribble, or that important?
Sure, yeah. So under dribble would probably fall under the category of difficulty peeing, and patients often volunteer, like, I have difficulty peeing, and when I do, it's just a dribble. So you don't need to necessarily ask specifically about a dribble. Phil's having a good time today. He's grinning the entire class. Probably all to do with whatever you guys were joking about earlier. It is Friday, it's the end of the day, everyone's tired, so once you get started laughing. Okay. yeah. Drew sits far away from you guys because you guys are trouble. You're bad influence. Brock's kind of this. Brock's kind of the straight man in the comedy act.
He's the only straight man in the group.
So tender to touch, fever, any history of similar complaints, last meal, last water taken, last menstrual period. Are they pregnant? If so, which trimester are they in? Have they had anything to eat or drink recently? Any nausea or vomiting? Came before the pain? Any hematemesis? Stooling, constipation, diarrhea, blood, dysuria, oliguria, anuria. Oliguria means... Matt? It means urinating, yeah, but what does it mean specifically?
Lack of urine.
Yeah, scant amount, like tiny, tiny amount, oliguria. Anuria would be no pee. No pee at all. Dysuria would be difficulty peeing. Polyuria would be frequent peeing, large volumes of peeing. Dysuria, oliguria, anuria, polyuria, hematuria, you can figure that one out. Blood in the pee. Or blood in the semen. You can ask about blood in the semen. I wouldn't say that's my typical line of questioning. I wouldn't typically ask that, but they might volunteer it. And depending on the age, so blood in the semen can be an infection, not necessarily a sexually transmitted infection, can be just an infection, can be an inflammation process, could be a tumor, could be benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, very common in older men, benign prostatic hyperplasia. So, but, so assessments, have you eaten anything different? Any excess alcohol or drug use? Any history of hypertension, heart disease, breathing disease? What position is most comfortable for you? Have you had any dizziness? That might be a perfusion issue. You can check for orthostatic vital signs. I think you guys have probably covered that in the lab, eh? Orthostatics. I rarely check for orthostatic blood pressure on people, but it's not a bad assessment to do. Check for pedal pulses, distal color, cap refill, and suspected triple A's. In cases dissected down the iliac arteries, look for pulsatile mass, but don't press it if you see a pulsatile mass in the abdomen. Okay. Last thing I want to do is push on that thing and rupture it. You know, push down and the patient says they feel a pop and they feel good for a split second and then they die. My fault. It's not good. They exsanguinate, that's right. They exsanguinate. And watching exsanguinate is like watching the lights dim with a dimmer switch. It's just a look of surprise and then slowly they fade. They're gone. It's a good way to go. If you're going to go, exsanguination wouldn't be a bad one. Bowel sounds. We don't do an EMS because it just takes too long. Look for distal cyanosis, for blood flow obstruction, tenderness, guarding, distension, bowel movements. Again, we want to ask about that. Any bleeding? We talked about that. If they look sick, they are sick. Management of the pain, so O2 for shortness of breath, dyspnea, or low saturation. But if they've got a good sat, but you're pretty sure that they've lost a significant amount of blood from a bowel movement or something, then they've got diminished oxygen carrying capacity. So oxygen by nasal prongs would not be unreasonable. It's really nice when people don't flush their toilet. We had a guy who had watery stool, and he left it for us, which was nice. It was smart, because I want to look at it. Only paramedics and nurses want to look at this stuff. You know, not normal. His toilet was just filled with red blood. It was just bright, bright red blood. And usually the water would dilute it, right? It would just look a pinkish color, but it was bright red. So that was good. And he had a good sat, but I gave him oxygen anyway because despite his saturation, I knew his oxygen carrying capacity was crappy. Unexplained poor saturation, suspected cardiac etiology, the usual ECG, SpO2 temperature. Ketorolac is great for renal colic. Ketorolac is the directive for ketorolac now is any pain, which is great. Otherwise, patch for analgesia if you really think you need to. IV fluid resuscitation, PRN, so if they're hypotensive, we can give them a 20 cc per kilo bolus. And we want to take abdo pain seriously. About 10% of abdo pains are potentially life-threatening. And just remember that that's the ones we're seeing in the ER. The ones we see in the field, it's probably a higher percentage because fewer people will actually call 911 for abdo pain. Unless it's a nursing home patient and the nursing home staff that are calling. Any questions about poop, vomit, pee, vaginal discharge? It's exciting stuff. Okay.